Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This program is all about empowering you and other people in your lives. And I'm so delighted that we are going to have today as a guest Dr. Joseph Williams. His book is titled, Who Do You See in the Mirror? And we're going to talk about why he got that title, what the purpose is behind the title, and how it can make a difference in your life as well as in the lives of the people that you know and you love. Dr. Williams, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
Well, I am very impressed with this publication. I think that Who Do You See in the Mirror is quite a significant statement about how we as individuals need to be aware of responsible behaviors. We have very, very poor examples that are being put in front of us in the media. A lot of people have become very, very disillusioned because of the lack of ethics and integrity. I want my audience to know a little bit about your background. You yourself decided that you wanted to take a positioning that really is a rather unique one. You were a CEO of a company, and then you decided to step into an entirely different environment. Give us the story behind that and why you decided to do it.
Well, I had been in management for 30 years, and I really had zero experience working as an hourly employee. So I said, if I'm going to write a book about responsible and irresponsible behavior in the workplace, I think that I need to match my talk with my action and go undercover and be able to observe it and be tested, have my own ethics tested under those conditions. So I was able to do, able to get it, all of my data raw. Raw meaning I didn't have a tape, I didn't have a tape recorder, I didn't have sit there with a pencil with an interview. I was one of them, and I was able to come home every night and get on my computer and write what I observed in the conversation. So it worked out really good for me to get the stuff raw like that. So that inspired me to do that. And, of course, my mother, it gave me a little urge myself because I know when I was young, I acted irresponsibly, and she was able to kind of set me on the right track all the time.
You put this into a little bit of a fictitious format, but it's all truth. You
Yes.
have used a garb of an environment, a stage setting of a coffee shop. And the information that you present in this book I found quite interesting. Now, how long, first of all, what positioning? Here you are, someone that's in an executive positioning for over 30 years. You step away from that because you want to walk your talk. I know I'm repeating your words, but I think they're very significant. What kind of a job did you get?
Oh, I was working at the airport as a, they call it customer service agent, but it's really a bag handler. I was meeting your plane, getting the bag, collecting the bags, and taking them to another flight. So I was actually a bag handler. I was able to see, and marshal the plane in. I enjoyed that, and riding on the little tugs, going from plane to plane.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very, very physical type of a job,
mm-hmm.
And that fit within me because, number one, I'm an exerciseaholic. I love to stay in shape, and this gave me that that opportunity as well, besides being able to collect the behaviors of different people under different settings and be able to see all this, live.
Well, I think
real
that's,
life.
Yes, I think that's incredible. I don't know how many people would really want to do something like that. But your comment right in the introduction of your book, there's actually two particular comments that I'm going to read verbatim. One is behavior is everything that humans do. And number two is the trend towards irresponsibility is a greater threat to the world's security than the proliferation of nuclear weapons or guns. Weapons themselves, being inanimate objects, do not kill. Killing occurs as a result of human action. Your words to me, I mean, they are such common sense, yet, as someone once told me when I was quite young, common sense isn't so common. And this is something that you found, too, when you were doing this. How long did you work as a baggage handler?
Absolutely. 7 years.
Seven years, actually.
And I was, I guess, matter of fact, I hadn't completed my PhD totally. I was just at the end of my PhD when I first joined the union, you know, being an hourly employee. And as I began to work there and continue on going to school, I said, well, gee whiz, you know, this is a great opportunity to do my study. But I was able to, when I finished my dissertation, I got my dissertation published on a global level right away. And that kind of surprised me. I mean, my dissertation was published in the Management Review Journal of New England, and it's distributed in 8 countries. And they sold, you know, 15 million copies of that journal, and it's in every MBA school in the world. So I was quite shocked it was that easy to, you know, to be able to get something published. So, but that gave me the motivation to share my research with the general public, and that's when I wrote the book, Who Do You Know?
Your statements are very clear. They're very much to the point. There's no mumbo-jumbo or what I call pseudo-psychological fluff that so often is dumped out. You really get to the core because you feel like you've got to get down to the core positioning of what is going wrong before you're going to be able to heal the overall distortion that has evolved for a long period of time. And you say irresponsibility is a serious threat to the success of the workplace, and an enterprise is a non-living organ of the business organization, and as such, it cannot decide, act, or behave by itself. A business succeeds or fails according to the responsible or irresponsible behavior of its personnel, both management and non-management, who are the living organ of the organization. I read that and I thought, gee whiz, that is just so well stated. Why is it more people don't get it?
Well, that sometimes it escapes me, Donna. But you're right. I tried to lay it out pretty clear, Chris, so I didn't confuse anyone. I didn't want to use those elaborate terms. I wanted to, you know, to make sure it was, you know, what realistic, and it's everyday stuff. So that kind of helped me a lot in formulating the book. But what was surprised me is that if we don't, you know, we have systems for manufacturing systems, we have distribution system, we have financial system, we have policy procedures written on all of this paper. And I consider that the word part of the documents with words. But then the actions, what I found out that the action to match those words, that each year they seem to be increasing a wide gap between what is said and what is actually done. And I said, gee whiz, why isn't it that we don't focus or come up with a system that deals with the human behavior? Because an organization succeeds or fails based on the living organ part of the organization, which is human behavior, period.
Absolutely. After all, without the human beings, we wouldn't have this radio show.
Absolutely.
You could have all the technology in the world, but without the human beings behind it, it's not going to happen. Thank you very much.
You got that right.
So I really like what you have here. I would like to see this as mandatory reading for all high school kids.
Yes, we're working on that now.
Well, I'll tell you, and I so that the teachers, the people in education, get the picture and the kids are made aware of it. I think it has to be on all levels. This is, and that's something you bring out. Now, let's talk about the coffee shop theme. I really enjoyed that because it was ground level. It is something that anybody could relate to. We all have maybe been in a coffee shop, whether it is a Starbucks or a local coffee shop diner, you know, in our neighborhood where we have one in our neighborhood where people, they say, oh, gee, go to XYZ place because it's going to be the best shop you can ever go to. They serve fabulous breakfast, and you can sit there and you can just talk all you want. And you created that. You said, this is what I want, a coffee shop. What spurred that particular theme for you? Is it because you have one like that in your own neighborhood?
Absolutely. When I was back east working, I would go after work, a group of us began to go to work, after work, and we would sit around, and the discussion would start on some global or some national issue.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just enjoy each other's company, and as a way of unwinding at the same time. Mm-hmm. We got the chance to know the servers that would wait on us, and became very, you know, friendly with them and et cetera. And I enjoyed that so much. And I was able to get so much I was able to get some education from real life people under the stress of the day. And
mm-hmm.
that's what that was.
I think it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. I really think it makes it very palatable because you're not saying we met at the Four Seasons. This is where we had our coffee clutch. No, that's not what you're saying. You're saying this starts, what we have to start with is the average Joe, the average Jill. Let them know how important they are and that they can make a difference. And that is one of the themes in your book I really, really admire. Now, you make a statement in your book, and I know that there is validation for this, that
Hello?
Hi, this is Donna. We had a little bit of a burp with our telephone lines here. Dr. Williams, what I had started to say is that in your book you make a statement that corruption had increased 30% over a period of a year in your story at the coffee shop. And you say responsibility goes from the bottom rung of the ladder all the way up to the top. And there is a lot of commentary because your story starts out with people getting together, and you're saying, okay, we're just going to chat about these things. Let's chat about responsibility and those that are and are not. And you then go into Common Sense Principles, a standard workplace guide. Let's talk about some of those principles. What are they? You gave five of them.
Okay, I'll give three here that I thought that was important, okay? And the first, and without meeting the first one, probably, you know, it's probably the most one that you want to focus on. Be honest with yourself and others in both your word and your action. And that was said for a reason. Word matching your action. And that was noticeable when organizations see irresponsible behavior happen before their eyes, and they let the employee off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And each time they let them off the hook, it erodes the organization by letting them off the hook, and they are accepting what I call substandard work. And not only that, worse off that, then they give them a raise for the mm-hmm. substandard work. Mm-hmm. So each time they do that, they are enhancing failure. And that's not the way you want to go. You're going to want to enhance success. And the only way you can do that is face the issue and make sure you do it, you know, immediately when it happens, as close to the incident when it happens. And that way you will be able to, you know, correct the situation. And the other thing is, if you don't do it then and productivity goes down, you will end up hiring five people when you only need three to do the work. And then they pass that on to the consumer. And if I was competitor, I could probably, if I ran my organization, that's a little bit more efficient, I could probably give you a lot of competition by doing that. And that's the sad part of it, is that we are passing the buck again, you know, to, you know, instead of facing it. And that's the reason I named the book, "Hey, Who Do You See in the Mirror? Look in the Mirror," you know. And we've been using that term in psychology for years and years. And I matter of fact, my mother used to tell me, "Hey, you ought to go look at yourself in the mirror if you, you know, on your own behavior before you start talking about others." And that stayed with me a little bit too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, your mother was a very wise woman. Today in the news, it seems like every day there is a statement about major corporations who have committed out and out fraud. You bring up the example of Enron. You bring up a number of different, very public, well-known entities whose upper management was appalling. I know of the companies where it wasn't just upper management. It went all the way down to the lower management, and the whole system was so bad that I have known of people that worked within those systems that said, "I'm going to quit. I cannot be a part of this because the house of cards is going to come tumbling down, and it's really serious. It's going to be nasty," which with many of these companies it has been. On the other hand, what I respected and appreciated, because I just don't like bashing against business. Without good business, you don't have a healthy economy. But you bring out the point about companies, and you mentioned one, the CEO of the Japanese Airlines, Haruka Nishimatsu, and how when they reached a very difficult point, he rode public transportation instead of having the limo take him to and from his office. He took a cutback. In other words, it was from the top all the way down through the organization.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think that's we should have more of that.
Yeah.
But it was hard for me to find examples of that. And that, can you believe that? trying to find some good examples.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there are out there. There are still some out there because I worked for a company 20 years, and this guy, the CEO, ran the company as treat others as you want to be treated, and that rubbed off on me. You know,
mm-hmm.
he's chairman of the board, and he said the only person that can overrule my decision is this guy here. And he was pointing at me, and I was, you know, head of the quality assurance department, you know, and I said, "Here is." I said, and he ran it that way, and he set a good example. I mean, he just treat everybody with respect. And people were happy, and they didn't, and we were a non-union company, and we got a lot of productivity out of
mm-hmm.
that group.
Mm-hmm. Well, people have a sense of pride. I have known a manufacturing facility where when they really hit hard times, what the CEO of Japan Airlines did, they themselves did, and they called the employees and said, "This is what we've hit. This is what's happening." They didn't lie to the employees. And when finally they had to close their doors, the
mm-hmm.
employees that had worked for them went on their own to assist the owners for 2 months to help them do what they needed to do. There was that much caring on the part of the employees about a company that they knew had been put under due to economic times, not because they had not been treated fairly or anything like that. And that shows you the character of people. And it really was very hard on the people that owned the business because they didn't want to have to close it. They knew the impact. These were very responsible people. they knew the impact it was going to have on literally 500 to 1,000 people immediately.
Yep, that's right. Well, there was one other example of, I think it's his name was Mr. Leonard A. Best. He was the owned a bank down in Miami. And he sold his, and the national bank sold his bank to a larger bank. And he took $60 million of his proceeds and went back and gave it to those employees who stood, you know, by him and worked mm-hmm. and was loyal to him for years and years and years. He went and gave them back. And some of them had retired. And he went from the small, the lowest level, the bank clerk, all the way up to the managers. But he did not, you know, just put it all on the top. He divided it up. And mm-hmm. those are some good examples, you know, of people. And I like what Bill Gates and, you know, and Warren Buffett is doing that. Now, they recently, see, they walk, they talk. They know what, you know, the virtue of giving back to the community. And now they have now gotten, what, 40 other billionaires to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and you think that they would have some difficulty doing that if they didn't do it that themselves. And this idea of do what I say, not as I do. We have been doing that, Donna, for years and years and years, and it's been passed down from generation to generation to generation.
Mm-hmm.
It has never worked, and it really erodes the setting of teaching by, you know, leading instead of mm-hmm. by talking.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to get rid of that. And I'm hoping that the book that, you know, is going to be the first start, and I'm going to take that book and then also in the next two or three years, I will be, you know, doing a series on that. The next book will focus on the teenager. The next book will mm-hmm. focus on marriage couples or relationships. But I'm going to go around, I'm going to try to touch the 6.8 billion people in the world. That's exactly what my goal is.
Well, I'm glad we're starting with my show to a degree because I'm very pleased to be a part of that message. You just talked about irresponsible behavior and how we need better examples. In your book, you say when governments, corporations, schools, and church leaders are caught being so irresponsible, one has to wonder where are the positive role models? And I get concerned because there's no accountability. It's like you said just a moment ago, you just pass the buck. Or you psychoanalyze something into dust and say, well, we'll blame it on the dog, we'll blame it on the environment, we'll blame it on here, there, everywhere. There is that point in life where sometimes you have external situations affect you like a Hurricane Katrina. Nobody had control over that. But it's what you do with what happens. And when we have publicly, day in and day out, the revelation of this person lied, this person is fraudulent, this person will say one thing and do something else. I mean, it's so disgusting. And yet I know for a fact there's a lot of good people, a lot of responsible people, and they're out there doing the best they can every day, and they get so weary. And sometimes they say, is the fight worth it? I say it is.
Oh, yes.
But how do we get back to that accountability, Dr. Williams? Because what you're saying is true. It's not make-believe. It is true.
Well, one of the things that I did in the book was came up with a totally new way of approaching behavior. First of all, I wanted to make it a system. And I lucked up on that, actually. I wanted to examine all the elements that goes up to make human behavior. And when I began to look at that and began to observe people behaving, I said, you know what? I think that the elements that we have in behavior has been misinterpreted because what we try to do is treat those five elements, which is consequence, attitude, your behavior, your learning, and environment. We have been treating those as mutually exclusive of one another, and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
There are three elements that are mutually, well, matter of fact, all of them should be treated as mutually inclusive. But when you when your attitude, which is your, you know, your disposition toward your job or toward another person, is positive, and once you make a charge as to act against that, you know, your attitude, the consequent automatically comes with your behavior. That's the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And those two, the behavior and consequent, has what is called a cause and an effect reaction. And then once you have a consequent, the learning is also a cause and effect relationship with the consequent. So then I said, gee whiz, those five elements have to be treated mutually inclusive of one another. And that, and so I began to reformulate that and test it out by observing people and talking with them. And sure enough, that's how I was treating them. They would say, hey, gee whiz. And I said, well, now I understand when a person go on a diet, they stay there, you know, they it's probably the hardest thing to do, to, you know, to keep it consistent without mm-hmm. coming back. Well, I said, well, I can tell you why. That's why they're doing that. They're only treating a couple of those elements. I mean, they go in with a positive attitude, and they try to change their action. And then they, the consequence, of course, is negative, and the other two are positive. And when that happens, you're not going to be able to sustain that change, because that change is not going to be sustainable, because they, you got a negative going against a positive, and it just don't last that way. They just don't. And I found that by just asking the people and come back and observe and say, how you doing in doing it? And they come back and tell me, here's what happened.
mm-hmm. You talk about so many aspects of the mind. You talk about the human cable system, HCS, that you trademarked at the Behavioral Makeover Process. And you go into that in your book. There is so much wisdom here. I like the way you have incorporated the use of story to get your points across. The different individuals that are listed. Again, there's so much fact in what you have presented. I think this is a book that would serve well anyone that really wants to make a difference, because they can read it for themselves first, and then they can incorporate it and be the walking example of the best that they can possibly be. And I think that's all about accountability and being honest with yourself, and even more. Dr. Williams, what is your website where people can go and get your information?
Okay, that's www.drjawcsms.com.
All right, so that is DR, like doctor, DRJAW, C like Charles, S like Sam, M like Mary, S like Sam dot com.
Right.
DRJAWCSMS.com.
Yeah, absolutely. CSMS stands for Common Sense Management Strategy.
Yes, sir. You've got it. Well, Dr. Williams, I think your book is so well done that no matter where you would take it, the standard of excellence that it promotes and support is long overdue. And though you spent 7 years as a baggage handler using that as your ground point to gain perspectives and new paradigms that you yourself as a former CEO had not personally experienced, this is really a tremendous accomplishment. And I congratulate you. I think it's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
And it's been a delight having you as my guest today. My guest today has been Dr. Joseph A. Williams. The book, Who Do You See in the Mirror? Change Irresponsible Behavior in the Workplace, but on All Levels of Life, those are my words, to Responsible Behavior. This is important, and this would be a good read for teenagers, too. This is something that supports right thinking and right action, and it belongs right in your library. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. We'll be coming back in just a moment. Don't go away. Again, thank you, Dr. Williams, for mm-hmm. being my guest.
Thank you.
Welcome, my lords and ladies, to the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, located at Maris Farms in Buckley, Washington. For 3 weekends in August, starting August 7th and 8th, we will transport you back to the days of old, where magic and merriment reign. Come see the multitude of musicians, dancers, jugglers, gypsies, peasants, nobles, pirates, and prestidigitation. That's magic for you commoners. Learn to swing a sword or shoot a bow and be knighted by Her Majesty the Queen. Hold your breath as jousters wheel their mounts around to engage in full contact combat on the field of battle. Sign on to sail the seas with scurvy pirates, or sit down with friends and family for turkey eggs and a fine brewed ale. Delights abound for the young and old at the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, so come one and all, starting August 7th and 8th, for fun and excitement, and may your day be fair. For tickets and info, go to www.washingtonfair.com.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Yes, we're back, and today we have a special guest. We have a man whose magic is magic. His name is Zinger. He is very much involved with the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, and you've been hearing me talk about it for weeks. Well, Zinger is with us today because we're going to be telling you a little bit more about some of the phenomenal things that are going on at this annual event. And Zinger, welcome to the show.
Well, good afternoon to you. You know, we only meet when we're talking and doing magic at something.
I know. Isn't that awesome?
Well, yeah.
It just makes everything absolutely special. Zinger, you have been involved with the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair for how many years? Is it 13 or 14 years this has been going on?
I've been doing Renaissance Fairs for about 15, and this is probably, I'd say 12.
Okay. 12 or 13
here in the hometown.
Here in the hometown. Now, we have got so much going on with this event that is absolutely phenomenal, but I would like for you to relate a little bit about your background. The Renaissance Fair started in the 60s. How did you become involved with magic, and how did magic evolve into the Renaissance Fair?
Well, remember that all magicians are liars, so a bit of this is going to be untruth. We're honest liars. I want to have that up front.
Okay.
I was an amateur for about 10 years and enthusiast for 30 years while I had a day job and did the normal 9-to-5 things, and then turned professional over 12 years ago. And the interesting thing was when I decided that I wanted to do performing magic beyond just being fascinated with it as a hobby and something to spend my thinking time on, what I did was a fellow named Dr. Goodhand said, I do Renaissance fairs. And I said, what's a Renaissance fair? I mean, I never dressed up and went to one of those things. He said, come along. I came along, and I've been in tights and pantaloons and really frilly stuff ever since. Do 5, 6, 10 Renaissance fairs a year.
What I find is that the people that are involved with the Renaissance theme and with the Renaissance Fair really have a love of theater. They have a love of going into this alternate time frame, and they play the role so fabulously. And one of the things that I get such an absolute joy from is watching the faces of the children when they're with their moms and dads or members of families, the aunts, the uncles, the grandpas. It's just wonderful because their eyes get so big when they see these unique costumes and characters that come to life in front of them. They see the knights jousting and all of this stuff. And the magicians, they just absolutely love. And, of course, you've got the gray-white beard and you just look really like this unique magician. But I was surprised to learn when we were chatting with this first weekend event, and of course for those of you in the state of Washington, this is in Buckley, this is at Maris Farms, and it's two more weekends and you can come on out. But with this, we were talking about the costuming, and you wear a coat that is actually period, and you were telling me how you and other members of staff at the Ren Fair actually go to schools to educate children about history. Tell us about this coat, the pocket history, and all of this that you shared with me on Sunday.
Oh, yes. Well, first realize that living history is an imaginary sort of thing. It's what, you know, the winner writes the history. We're doing much better with that now. But most everything we do in an imaginary realm is to try to recreate the good or the bad parts of history. And one of the ways to do that is the way that at least the performers dress. Patrons, visitors often surpass what we do. But the way to do that is to go back and look. I was not at all interested in history until I started doing Renaissance fairs, and then it became alive, and I said, I want to do this. Well, when I go to schools and when we're traveling the West going to Renaissance fairs, I try to go to schools, do an hour program with lots of touchy-feely things, you know, costumes and all that sorts of things, to make it so that the dull dates and the wars and the deaths and the births, you know, there's something added, there's some flesh added to that. And so we always, you know, try to get something that's more authentic. My character happens to be one of two princes, crown princes, and that's why it's royal magic. We couldn't afford to be traveling like we do if it wasn't supported by royalty. My mother decided we should be out of the country, at least one of us. And so in doing that, I decided, well, I have to dress as well as royalty would if they were pretending to be of a less rank. And so one of the things that distinguishes people with lots of money, and particularly royalty, is that they wear jewelry and they wear furs. And this particular cloak I was wearing, because the weather was a little cloudy, is a recreation of, we think it is the Archbishop of Canterbury. It could be the Archbishop of Glastonbury, but the Archbishop of Canterbury's cloak. And one of the interesting things about it, it's got lots of imitation fur on it, and you know, it's just made following the patterns that history has found of that. And one of the interesting things is that there's a pocket in it. This time period, pockets are put on the outside. They're sewed on, and they're just kind of like a sewed-on piece of fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the examples of the first inside pockets, and it was probably for a piece of cloth, a handkerchief, or something like that. But it's right in the seam. And it's just fascinating, this, you know, and it's one of the reasons I love it, because it's this little piece of, you know, we did bring it to schools and we say, you have to realize you're used to pockets. Well, they didn't have pockets. They had pouches. That's why they were cut purses, you know, and they didn't really have pockets, and they didn't carry very much in pockets either. People carried it for them, or they carried them in, you know, little satchels or purses or those sorts of things.
And men had what we'd call purses because, again, like you said, they didn't have the pockets. And you look at some of the costumes, there wasn't space in the clothing for pockets, really.
Not really. Particularly, one of the things I always, when people who go to Renaissance fairs for the first time look around and think, ooh, what is this? The second and third time they say, I want to be a little bit more involved in this. Then they start buying things and they start deciding, I want to be this. And there's the very rich and the very poor. And if anyone wants to costume, and it's great fun to just throw yourself, this is not a spectator sport, it's an interactive sport. You're gathering memories and possibly taking home some mementos. But people always want to be royalty or rich nobles. Well, you have to dress well. The clothing is very heavy and it's very hot, and it's usually very tight. And so there are no places to put extra things. You know, you may carry a dagger or a knife, but you don't, you know, there's no place for lunch, there's no place for cell phones, and there's no place for books and notepads and those sorts of things.
Right. It's a fascinating era. And I think that that is what is so intriguing about being part of the Ren Faire. Also, one of the factors that I think is just delightful, and it's what we have at the Ren Faire in Buckley at the Maris Farms, it is the fact that you have potters that are actually making pottery right there on site. You have toolsmiths that are banging away. You'll hear them, and they're just doing all kinds of stuff. You have artisans of all levels, and they're trying to keep it right in the theme of that time period. And I'll tell you one of the things. The very first Ren Faire I participated in, which was about 10 years ago, I thought to myself, I'm so glad I live in this modern era. This would not do for me. I just don't like it. I'm spoiled rotten, Zinger. I really like being spoiled. And this was really a rugged time period. It was not an easy time.
It's brutal and dirty and filthy. And luckily, we when we recreate it, we ignore a lot of that. We mm-hmm. realize we're doing 21st century in reality.
Right.
We're having fun. We're, you know, it's that sort of thing. But we try to recreate it, and it is not, you know, yeah. I mean,
it is not. When you really get into the history of it and you're out on this area of farmland, you're really going to get a feel for it. You're going to get a taste for it. And it is an eye-opener. It really, really is. I'll tell you what, I'm really glad for the porta-potties. I'm very glad, you know, for the sanitation.
I don't camp either. I stay over, but I really don't camp, and I'm pleased when the weekend is over and I can do something else.
Yes, yeah, so you go home and get a shower and all this stuff. But, you know, when you think of it, now when you're talking about the royalty, and this is something that people don't realize, you think of Queen Elizabeth. She had 32,000 dresses in her wardrobe when she came into power. I mean, it was, or was it 16,000? It was 16,000, I think. I think it was Catherine the Great that had 32,000. She inherited it from Elizabeth, but that's Russia. But I think Queen Elizabeth had 16,000 dresses because they didn't have deodorant and things couldn't be laundered. They didn't have a dry cleaner down on the corner. I mean, to do laundry in the Renaissance period, good luck.
And also, if you were rich, why would you wear the same thing twice?
Absolutely.
I mean, you showed your money. One of the things that's coming up this Saturday, if people are going to come, is that Amy Brown, the fantasy artist, is going to be at the Renaissance Fair on Saturday.
That's
I thought
right.
I'd be sure to mention that.
Oh, yes. And we've got so many other things. And Maid Marian and Robin Hood are also going to be there on the weekend.
Yes, they do a wonderful show on one of them on our stage that mm-hmm. You know, involves children. And if somebody's coming to the Renaissance Fair, I always like to point out you have a choice between violence and magic. And I mean that literally. At 11 o'clock is the joust. At 11 o'clock is Royal Magic's show. At 2 o'clock is the acrobatic riding. At 2 o'clock is Royal Magic's magic show. There's another joust at 4 o'clock. So, I always tell people to pick the one that was missing in their life.
Ah, well, there is so much going on, and not only that, but the food is absolutely awesome. And we had a record turnout this weekend. This coming weekend, the weather is going to be absolutely spectacular. And for those of you in the state of Washington, the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair is a must attend. It is a family event. It is something that will be memorable. You can talk to the people that are participating. You will find that the people that participate in this event are just absolutely delighted to interact with you and to talk with you, and it will be a memory that you're going to want to share with others and to repeat it again yourself. So again, Zinger, thank you so much for being with me today, and I'm looking forward to seeing you on this weekend, because I'll be there in my costume as well. And I so appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to chat about an event that I think is spectacular and really speaks well for an event that just about everybody should go at least once to experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. See you Saturday.
I look forward to that, Zinger. This is Donna Sebo. We've been talking with Zinger, the magician, and we will be performing, appearing, whichever word you'd like to hear, at the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Festival in Buckley, Washington at Maris Farms. Go to their website and check out all of the information you need. They have the map there, whatever you want. And this all occurs, again, in Buckley, Washington. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open. The number to call into if you'd like for me to light up your life is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And remember, all I need is your first name or initial, and then just let me tell you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you like. Also, I'm still receiving stories from people regarding their paranormal experiences, and if you have one you'd like to share, send it along. I'm setting the end of the year as my goal of attaining 100 stories, and I'd love to have yours included, so please don't wait till the last minute. Send it to me via email, Donna@DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna@DelphiInternational.com. Now, this can be about a ghost experience. It can be about out-of-body, astral projection, which is the same as out-of-body. But anything, clairaudience, dream, precognition, whatever your experience has been, I think the more we can share in the way of stories, the better it's going to be. And everyone's is so unique. So I invite you to bring that to the forefront, and of course you get full credit in the publication, but I'm wanting to collect 100 stories, and I'd love to have yours. So again, Donna@DelphiInternational.com. And tomorrow, if you're like me, summertime has always represented the time to travel, to visit places that, well, maybe during the rest of the year you wouldn't have a chance to visit because the weather might be very cold or driving conditions might be very difficult. Well, we're going to have as a guest tomorrow, Diane Perrier. Her book is titled On Ramps and Overpasses. And you may think, well, you know, what good would that be? I don't want to talk just about roads. We're going to be talking about history. This country has a lot of stories to share regarding how roads were developed and how it enabled the development of businesses and the entire country overall. You know, without the infrastructure of roads, Transportation of goods and services just isn't going to be possible. And a lot that we take for granted today was not available easily 100 years ago, even less than that. So a lot of things have evolved in a relatively short period of time. Diane's done a great job with it. We'll be talking about that tomorrow and on Friday. This interview is very special to me. I know a lot of people with diabetes, and Dr. Rypek is my guest. This is a doctor who has been willing to work with patients to help them totally overcome their diabetic situation. And in many incidences, if they have been on insulin, they've been able to stop having to use it. How is it done? Through dietary patterning. And I think what he has to say is really going to be an eye-opener for you. So I'd like to invite you to join me. We've got wonderful guests. We're going to be talking about on Friday the 30-day diabetic cure. And he doesn't use the word cure lightly. Food is medicine. Dr. Rypek believes in that and knows it does make a difference because he deals with people that have this agenda every day. And I want to share with you, there is someone that we know that we work with, and by golly, this person has been following their dietary regimen. And when I first met this individual about a year and a half ago, they didn't expect to live another year because their internal organs, due to the severe case of diabetes and medications that they have been on, were literally deteriorating at such a speed, this woman didn't think she could make it. Through changing dietary patterning, she has been able to reverse so much. So we're going to be talking about this stuff on Friday. Mind games. Do you think your mind can become more agile? Do you believe that your brain has the capacity for regenerating itself? Well, I know if you're a regular listener, you've heard some of the interviews that I have had with scientists that have been doing research in this, and you would know the answer to the latter question I posed would be absolutely yes. The brain can regenerate itself. This, however, is a relatively new discovery because there was a time when scientists had the attitude, the brain was totally developed by the time you were 5-6 years of age, and that's it. That's the little gray cells you had. That's what you got, folks. You're not going to get any more. Well, they are finding that is not the case. So now they're having to reverse their positioning. Yahoo! Somebody finally got the wisdom to say, let's question this attitude. They've done that, and they're saying, no, if you stay active and if you have good nutrition, your brain, let's say you had a stroke or something like this, you literally can reverse what would have been considered an absolute in the minds of many. You can reverse that condition and come back because the brain can rebuild, but it will take effort. So what is happening here? This brain plasticity, it's there. You can reorganize and create new connections within the brain. Now, Donald Stuss, who is a senior research scientist at the Ruttman Research Institute of Baycrest, which is affiliated with the University of Toronto, is adamant about this. His research has brought forth some real interesting breakthroughs. Now, he said, there is a fact that, to the best of their knowledge, that the brain does lose some of its ability to concentrate when you start getting to be between the ages of 40 and 60. Well, think about it. The general attitude through generations is when you start getting to that, hey, you're getting a little bit older, you're going to get a little fuzzy. You're also going through big hormonal shifts, especially with the women. And having the fuzzy mental faculty positioning is not fun. And that is due to the hormonal ups and downs that go on. Well, they're finding that because of technology, we have the capacity to reverse that patterning. Nutrition, again, is very, very important, but the brain will continue to regenerate itself throughout one's lifetime. And they say it's giving your mind a mental workout. Now, it has been shown that people that are involved in music and performing stay younger, healthier, and their alertness is far much, you know, it's way, way up there. Why? Because music involves mathematics, it involves creativity, and all of these things are working. So that is very, very positive. But let me give you some websites. If you wanted to sharpen the brain, sharpen how you think, develop new skills, you're never too old to do it. Now, some people like to do crossword puzzles. There's all kinds of games that you can do, and you can do some online. There's a website called sharpbrains.com, and fitbrains, and luminosity.com, and cognofit.com. You know what? I just looked at the clock. I'm out of time. Holy Moses. Well, it's what happens when it goes by and you're having a great time, and I'm so delighted you were able to join me. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Your mind belongs to you, no one else. Keep it sharp. Keep it right there on that razor's edge of accomplishment that you can do. This is Donna Sebo. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.